My name is Mike Strauss, and welcome. I remember the first Marietta Roundup when it was at the old Marietta Convention Center in 1990, I think it was. In 1991, I got transferred from Atlanta. I got sober here in Marietta up to Charlotte, North Carolina. I knew nobody there. I had met one guy, Harry W., through a friend of mine here, and that was a treat. And I got up to Charlotte, and it was a little different there. Most of the meetings were speaker meetings. I went to a speaker meeting one night at a place called Queen City Group, and I heard a guy speak who I said, I think I'll ask him to be my sponsor. He's the exact opposite of my sponsor, who many of you remember, Norm here. This guy was quiet, composed, and calm. Everything that I'm not. And I said, I think I could learn something from this guy. And he gave me a couple of rules. One was, you should go to speaker meetings, big book meetings, and step meetings. That's where the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is. For the next 5 years, I cheated a little bit, but that's what I did. He also told me about meditation. When I told him I couldn't do it, he said, well, then get a professional to teach you. I still haven't learned to do it 10 years later. And I've enjoyed the time that I had with Bill up there. He came down here one time when I moved back here in 96 to speak at the Bishop Lake Group. And I haven't seen Bill since about 1997 or 1998. The neat thing is he hasn't changed one bit. I think you're really all going to enjoy his message. Thank you.
I'm Bill Crawford, and I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you.
And that was, thank you, Mike. I hadn't, as he said, I sponsored Mike. And as he said, it was 10 years ago, and I'm about over it. but I appreciate the kind words. I'm also grateful, more than I can describe, to be invited to this fine occasion, this Marietta Roundup. And I've heard a lot about it, and I know it's a good one, and you're privileged to speak at this this conference. So thank you for that. I want to thank Joe for picking me up at the airport, and I want to thank Carol and Ross and the other Joe and Mike and Cindy for having dinner with me tonight at a delight, Raised by the River, something like that. It was great. So with all the thanks out of the way, I can't think of another thing to say. and I've run into several old friends who've heard me before, and maybe more than once before, and I'm especially grateful to them for being willing to listen to me again. And so I'm comfortable here, and I just feel good. There's other speakers, particularly Clancy, who's been a hero of mine for years. I don't even think he's here listening to me, really. He did at least say hello. But I, by golly, I'll be here listening to him tomorrow night. So, when we're doing this, my assignment tonight, I know exactly what it is to tell my story. And when we do this, we're relating that miracle that occurs in our lives. And it's nothing short of that. It's a big deal. It's not a little deal. I didn't develop character or get smart or, to discover my inner child or anything. What has happened to... There's Clancy. I'm sorry I said that. I'm sorry. I really apologize. That was not me that said those things. I'm in trouble now. None of those things happen. A miracle, I believe, has occurred in my life, as it has yours, if you have found this thing we call recovering the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of us think, certainly the people who are surround us, those bosses and wives and husbands and parents and whatever, think that we lack willpower. And that's not the case at all. We've got too much willpower. There are people in this room that have gotten up and gone to work and worked all day that if a normal person felt half that bad, they'd be in intensive care. lack of willpower is not our problem. It's lack of another kind of power. And hopefully I can talk a little bit about that, or at least describe in a way that's understood how that powerlessness applied to me. Now, I came up in a home that we had, y'all come in, I'll start over. And I know these good folks had a good reason, you know. Well, anyway, I came up in a home with a dual problem. We had alcoholism and Southern Baptism right there in the same house. And as many of you know, you don't get over either one of those. You know, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a Southern Baptist, always a Southern Baptist. Once whatever you are, if you were born and raised a Roman Catholic or whatever, you just, there's a... I hate to quote Clancy, but he was talking about, I remember one of the first talks I ever heard him talk. He was talking about what Hitler's method was. If they could teach you Nazism in the first 7 years of your life, there'd be a little bit of Nazi in you for the rest of your life. And sometime we laugh and make sport of those good Christian homes that produce so many of us. But I believe that what many of us have learned at our mother's knee, whether we turned away from it or not, helped us maybe get this here, laid a kind of a foundation. Certainly, it made it so that it was difficult for me to live inside my own skin with what I knew, the morals that had been imposed on me. And I came up knowing that beverage alcohol was bad because of my religious training and because of what I witnessed in my home. And I knew, I guess, at some level, always, that I'd never drink. It was just not done. Because the only drinking I knew about was the kind that happened in our house and then a friend of mine up the street who had two alcoholic parents, and it was not attractive by any means. But I was having trouble adjusting early. I was having trouble satisfying the authorities and getting in the rhythm of the system. I had a difficult time. And that was back before they diagnosed you. You know, now they do that to kids. And they give them letters, you know, ADAH and HD and ADD. And the way I put it is I came along before Ritalin. I came along during paddling. Which was the drug used for kids like me back then. And they tried to adjust me in that way. And I would determine not to be bad. I would determine to keep my mouth shut in school, and I couldn't do it. And I just, you know that part in the big book where Bill says we sought lower companionship? I was doing that in the second grade. I was trying to, maybe unconsciously, but nevertheless, trying to find those folks that were like me. And as I began to come up, these are the ones who smoked the Lucky Strikes, and I became a cat, which many young people don't know what a cat was, but it was with the long duck tails and the squared off, you know, and the draped pants, and you wore the pants real low, and I became a cat for a while. I had a period where I hung around with the boys in front of Mansholt's Henry Drugstore, the rebels. And back then, what drug was available to us was alcohol. I knew very little about anything else. And I began to drink simply because they were drinking. Now, I learned later that's called peer pressure. That's something we do to be included in a group among people that we want to be included. And I began to use alcohol for that reason. And I think I had what you could call a true social drinking period there. And I think it was about 6 weeks that I was a social drinker. Where I had a sip of this and a half a can of that, and then one night, and I'm 15 and a half years old, I ingested enough cheap wine to no intoxication. And anything like social drinking, anything like drinking with impunity, anything like okay drinking was gone that night. Because it did something for me that the experts say it only does for 10% of the people who experiment with alcohol. It does. It made me comfortable in a world that for me, for the most part, was uncomfortable. It made me okay. It made me enough. It filled a hole that I didn't even know was there until I felt that feeling. Now, that's something that's hard to describe to people who are not in rooms like this. They can't understand that. They are the 90% who waste every drop they drink. We all know them. They're everywhere. They outnumber us 9-1. We marry them, you know. We go to work for them. Bosses are, it's epidemically non-alcoholics. And they don't understand us, and we don't understand them. But that special feeling, that special response to alcohol happened to me. And it's like my good friend, and this is the last time I'm going to quote Clancy, but as he says, if it doesn't do anything for you, it'll never do anything to you. And that's the deal. And I believe it's what it does for us that gets us in trouble. And it's what it does to us that hopefully gets us here or to some form of help. And my drunkalog is not a particularly exciting drunkalog. A lot of people say that, but mine is a fairly boring drunkalog. And it doesn't mean I was a functioning drunk. I was a unfunctioning drunk. I mean, I didn't function at all, but I didn't do anything exciting. You know, I didn't get on a plane and fly to Moscow or something on a drunk. I was just a drunk. Now, what happened to me is what happened to you, I believe, if you're alcoholic. Now, I love Dr. Silkworth's chapter, and lately, in recent times, when I've had the opportunity to do this, I talk a lot about that, because I think Dr. Silkworth was there on the firing line, a frontline observer, if you will, to us. Now, he didn't set out to do a scientific study of alcoholism or us, but he had empirical knowledge. In other words, he was running a hospital where he treated thousands of us. And he noticed certain commonalities, certain similarities with us. And I think they're pretty true. Now, sometimes if we're new, we hear differences and we filter out the similarities sometimes. And you may be sitting there and say, well, I may drink too much, but I'm not like that old guy up at the podium. But if you listen, if we open our ears and hearts long enough, we'll find that the similarities are so great, it's almost uncanny. We're so much alike, it's almost uncanny. And in the beginning, I think the absolute doorway, the precursor, the first requirement of alcoholism is that special thing it does for us. Silkworth talks about that too. He says, no matter what folks say, men and women drink because they like the effect. That's why they drink. They can say they like a martini, or they can, you know, I drink because my dog died or whatever. But what they like is the effect produced by alcohol, and that's why I drank. He talks about, he didn't know what else to call it. He said these people are not only different in their minds, they're different physically. They have a physiological difference. And I don't know what to call it, he said, except an allergy. They respond to this alcohol in a different way physically. If they take a drink, they have something he called the phenomenon of craving, something that happens physically that doesn't happen to other folks. You ever been out drinking with somebody, be at some convention or something with business, and somebody switches to coffee or something? You ever done that? Just a terrible thing. You know, because when I knew about the phenomenon of craving way back, not the term, but I knew that response to alcohol. I knew that I had been in a situation young, in my teens, where I would refuse a drink when I knew that that's all I was going to get. I would refuse a drink when I wanted to drink very badly. Because I knew if I took a drink or a couple of drinks, the agitation, the discomfort, the craving would manifest, and I would feel worse than if I didn't have any at all. I knew about the phenomenon of craving, unique to our class. Another thing the experts say is these amnesia spells that we call blackouts, peculiar to our class, the 10%. These 9 in 10 don't have that. Now, we're not the only ones that can become intoxicated. Non-alcoholics can become intoxicated and often do. We're heading into the 4th of July. We just passed the Christmas and New Year's season when non-alcoholics will take a drink or two or three or four or five or six. And they'll go to parties and they will ingest enough alcohol to feel it. And they'll be out there on the road like New Year's Eve. Nothing more dangerous than a non-alcoholic with a blood alcohol count of about a 0.06. All over the road. There are people in this room that have been blowing a 30, driving straight as an arrow, because of the training. Now, we've learned things that they don't know, like this. They don't know that. That's a conditioned reflex. You get those lines down to 1. Straight as an arrow. Might be going 17 miles an hour. But we're going straight because of the training. Might have our head out the window. But that non-alcoholic who's intoxicated, no matter to what extent, will remember everything. That peculiarity of amnesia or blackout doesn't happen to him. I'm like a friend of mine. I had them when they first came out. I had them when I was young. And I would get reports of what I did and who I was with and what I said and this kind of thing. And I began to realize that I hadn't remembered this. And I was walking and talking and functioning. Some people even didn't even know I was intoxicated, and I could not remember. Peculiar to our class. That happened to me very early in the drinking. And I began to lose control of the amount I drank. That's alcoholism. Non-alcoholics don't do that. Or if they do it, they do it once. And most importantly, I begin to lose control or the prediction of my behavior, how I was going to act. And my behavior became not only unpredictable, but more antisocial and more unacceptable. And all of this didn't happen the first week, but it happened pretty quick with me. My whole drinking career was probably not a day or two over 14 years. I started drinking when I was 15 years old, and I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by the grace of God when I was 29. And by the grace of God, through this moment, I hadn't had a drink since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that first time. But I'll talk a little bit about that. I tried everything that we try. Alcoholics do. I would try to drink only beer, because that's always, I think, is what alcoholics do. I've heard many of them say to me, since I've tried to do the 12-step work in this program, I only drink beer. If I'm an alcoholic, I couldn't be a bad one. I only drink beer. And I would try that. And I would drink beer for long periods of time. And beer was also my detox medication, too. If I was been on a drunk, that'd be the... I know we all enjoy those commercials. Especially when you watch during the sports season and everything, the beer commercials, the Silver Bullet, the Budweiser. And they're either funny or they got the good-looking people drinking that beer and having such a good time. And the women are beautiful and the men are strong. That commercial was never shot at my house. And if you're new, and you say, I need to maybe quit drinking, and I maybe need to enjoy these folks, but I'll never have any fun again. I'll come in here and I'll drink coffee and eat cake and all that stuff, but I'll never have any fun again. Let me tell you about my fun beer drinking. The antithesis of those commercials. I'd get up in the morning, you know, or the morning, the afternoon, whenever you come to, and I'd have that feeling that only can be described as that the one who is allergic to this substance in that hangover, withdrawal from this thing. And I would try to drink that beer down to put out the fire and to get the nerves calm. And I would get as much beer down. I never was standing in the right place when I did this. I'd be near the refrigerator instead of near the toilet when I do this. And I'd get that beer down, and that gag reflex would hit me. It would get down about that far. It would come back up, and I'd grab my mouth, and I would blow it out my nose. Now, you miss that when you come down here, eh? So I've often thought, it's sort of a counter. Maybe some agency could run, some government grant to run a counter ad to the tug of war out on the beach drinking the silver bullet and have a pretty girl blow one out her nose. To show there's another side to the beer drinking. And this was my fun beer drinking toward the end. And I had, from drinking where I couldn't stop, as I've described, and my behavior becoming antisocial, unpredictable. And, of course, as we say, I discovered the morning drink, which means I got into bender binge drinking. And as you've already heard me say, this is somebody in his 20s, not in his 60s like I am now, or 50s, 40s, or even 30s, but a young man who was drinking around the clock, drinking for oblivion, drinking in the bed, drinking just to get out of the world. And I would determine at this time, when I'd come off these drunks, I would determine I'm not going to do it anymore. And I'd make that promise. It's the emptiest promise in the world, but see, I didn't know it. When the alcoholic says to me, when I'm trying to help somebody, you know, this was so bad. I got so sick. I did so much damage. I've hurt them enough. I've humiliated myself enough. I'll never do this again. I know the lie's not to me. The lie's to him or to her. The lie was never really, or most of the time, it was never to them. It was to me. I meant it. And when that boss would rehire me, or when my wife Kay would forgive me and my parents would make it be okay again, I would set out on those fresh starts to not drink. And sometime it lasted a week, and sometime it lasted 2 weeks, and one time it lasted a month. But I would go back in to buy some more of that poison one more time because nothing else filled the hole. I didn't have anything else to come in and do it. And so I would repeat that thing over and over again, as many of us do. I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't drink. And I don't mean I couldn't bend my elbow and swallow. I couldn't drink successfully. I couldn't drink without getting sick. I couldn't drink without hurting me and others. I couldn't drink without damage being done. I couldn't drink and stop. But more importantly, what we're celebrating here, what we're about in this room, is I could not drink. There's nothing that can be done about that part of me that can't drink. That's always there. If I'm sober 100 years, I'm just 100 years worse off to be able to tolerate alcohol than I was when I quit. But what I have overcome with God's help and yours help is that part of me that can't not drink. That's what happened to Bill Wilson. I love Bill's story in the big book. Bill's story is my story. Your story too, I guess. Bill was in the, as we know, in that famous hotel lobby, which I had the privilege of visiting a couple of years ago, which turned into a museum, the Mayflower Hotel in Akron. And he had he'd been sober for 6 months. That was a long time for Bill. He'd not only been sober 6 months, he had had a super colossal spiritual experience. I mean, almost out-of-body deal. Not only that, but he had had insight given to him because he'd been working with a therapist. He had self-knowledge. And beyond that, he'd even gone out and tried to help some other drunk. A lot going for him. And as you heard the story or read the story so many times, he paced that lobby. And he looked at the cocktail lounge. And he said, first, I'm just going in there and get some friends because it feels so bad this business deal has fallen through. and I'm all alone. And if you ever know what it's like as an alcoholic sober, coming to, it may be sober in a strange town, a strange place, you don't know anything. There's no loneliness, aloneness even like it. And then he said, no, I'll go in and just have a few drinks. And then a panic hit him, is the way I understand the story, and maybe the first time a panic had ever hit a drunk, as far as we know, as far as recorded, when that crazy thinking started. And through divine intervention, I think most of us believe, he realized that this was the same craziness that had gotten him started drinking time after time before. And that's when he got on the phone and dialed the phone and dialed the phone and dialed the phone until he got a hold of the right minister. And then through some other things, he was able to be in the company of Dr. Bob, and that's what started Alcoholics Anonymous. And so in the middle of July of 1966, I'm working for this crooked company, a pretty crooked company. It was the old bait and switch. I don't know if you know what a bait and switch is, but this was the old bait and switch deal, where you put storm windows on a house for $5.55 each. And you average, or you put siding on a house for $279, the whole house. And you go out and sell these people siding for $279. And you'd say, by the way, have you seen that siding you bought? After they signed the mortgage on the house, and they'd most of the time they'd say no because they hadn't been to any showroom. We didn't have a showroom. And you bring in this piece of junk and you say, this is a siding you bought. Now, you need to wax that every other week or it'll fall off your house. And then we'd go out and get the good stuff, and after they'd bought the bad stuff that really didn't exist, and switch them over to the good stuff. And this is where I was working. This and everything else I was doing was totally against every moral teaching that I'd ever experienced. Totally against anything my conscience might dictate, if there was any conscience left. And that's where I was, and that's the kind of deal I was in. I later got into selling cars and this kind of thing, and that can be crooked too. Not all car salesmen can. But I was working for this crooked company when I came home from St. Louis. They sent me up to St. Louis for a couple of weeks. By then, I was in management. And I'd been drunk up there for 2 weeks. And I came back, and Kay picked me up at the airport. And I was in the airport tapering off. And this is what some of you heard me talk about this before. This is an art. This is self-detox. And I wasn't always perfect at it. And my wife would confuse tapering off with drinking. It looks a lot alike. I'd have to explain it to her time and time again. No, I quit drinking yesterday. Today I'm just tapering off. Now, what would add to her confusion is sometime I'd get drunk tapering off. I would just... And then I'd just start over. And I was standing in the airport lounge tapering off because it'd been a bad 2 weeks drinking some beer. And I guess on the way home when she picked me up, it was a hot July day, we stopped and got some more beer. And I came in there and got into my drinking, lounging clothes, my underwear. Part of my, that's what I did most of my drinking. I was a charming drunk. And it was oftentimes dirty underwear because I didn't bathe, I didn't eat, you know. And so I was standing there, and for whatever reason, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I hadn't got time, and you hadn't got the patience to listen to all the stuff I'd done prior to this. I'd done all kinds of stuff. I'd been in psychiatric treatment. When I was in the Army, I worked in a psychiatric ward. I was a neuropsychiatric technician. And it was all about me anyway, and I was hypochondriacal, and it was self, and I would think every disease I'd hear about, I'd get the symptoms. And when you're working in a psychiatric ward, and they're teaching you about the mental illnesses, and you're an alcoholic, it'll really screw with your head. I mean, they'd teach me about schizophrenia or something. I said, my God, I've got that. And I'd have that fear that somebody was going to discover what was going on inside of here, or I was going to fly apart or something. And they'd take me out of those white clothes and take away my keys and put me in those blue pajamas. Since I hadn't said this lately, that just reminds me, if you want a quick degree on alcoholism, if you're thinking about going into the field, you know, and working for it, I can save you some schooling, I think, because they've studied us a lot. You know, they've grants, great minds have studied us, and I don't object to that. This is, I think, a true illness, a true disease, as the American Medical Association said in 1956, and other professional organizations have owned up to that too, so I don't object to that. But not one penny has been spent, or not one great brain has been devoted to the study of those non-alcoholics. And that's a confusing bunch of people. Now, what I've done without benefit of grant, I've studied my wife, Kay, just over the years. Kind of a control group. She's right there. And she's probably one of the worst cases of non-alcoholism you've ever seen. Now, like on our anniversary, if we go out and eat or something, she'll drink a glass of white wine or something once a year, twice a year. But back in the past when we were dating in our early marriage, she had more than maybe a handful of occasions, times when she drank enough to feel it. You know what she does? I hate for the newcomers to hear this. She stops. When she gets the, now let me say that again, because I know it's unavoidable. She gets the pilot lit and she stops. Now that demands research. So I've said, why do you do that? More than once I've asked her, why do you do that? And she's told me more than once, well, when I start to feel it, I feel as if I'm losing control, and I don't particularly like that feeling, so I stop. Isn't that interesting? The only thing that ever gave me any semblance of control was that feeling. The only thing that came close to my having my hands around this deal was that feeling. And so the irresistible urge to continue drinking was irresistible. So that's all I need to know between the difference in us and them. I don't need to know anymore. They don't need to get another rat drunk or any of that other stuff. I'm satisfied with that much knowledge. So anyway, I go home and I call Alcoholics Anonymous. Doing all kinds of things. I'd gone to counseling. I considered myself an agnostic. I'd even been in counseling with a minister. Marriage counseling with the same minister, and all he would say repeatedly, he tried to help, but his mantra was, let me call somebody in AA, because he thought my problem was drinking. And I would say, no, not yet, let's work some other things out, particularly with anyway, I reached Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm gonna hurry this thing up and sit down so we can eat ice. That ice cream's high, isn't it? The tapes are about the biggest bargain I've heard. They're $5 most places, but the ice cream's high. I guess make it up with the ice cream, I guess. But anyway, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Looked it up in the phone directory. Standing there in my underwear, tapering off. Kay and the kids were out of the house. And I reached a man through the answer service. At that time, AA worked through an answer service. They all, they answered for two doctors and an oil company in AA, that kind of answer service. And I got Bill Norman. Some of you may have known Bill Norman. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and died as a member in good standing about 4 years ago. he called me, and he began to talk to me, and he began to realize that I was drinking. No matter, and I sort of told him, no, I'm just tapering off. And he figured he would understand if he was calling from the ANA headquarters, you know. And he wanted to call me back, and he wanted to talk with me when I wasn't drinking. But I got his name, and I got his number, and promised to call him back. And when Kay came home, I put that name and number in her face before she could say a word, you know, hush. I've turned myself into AA. He and I agree I'm not ready yet, but I'm going to call him when I am. Now, I believe, with all the baloney that was inside of me, all the lies that I live by, I'm not saying there was any sincerity or motivation in that call, but I believe it was desperation. You know, we don't do the 12-step work that we used to do, and it's kind of a pity. But, you know, you learn after a while, you know, fooling with those drunks. Not many of them meet you at the door and say, you got some steps I can start working. Yeah. So mental health counselors don't find many of us motivated or sincere or this guy. They put on our charts, confabulate. You know what that means? It lies. But there was desperation. So I had his name and number, and I said, I'm going to call him back, because I promised him I'd call him back, and I didn't. And I didn't call him back, and I didn't call him back, and I didn't call him back. And some months passed. And Kay called him. And she'd put that name and number in a safe place. And she called him, and I know now that what had happened, she got a strange man, a strange voice, someone she didn't know on the phone. She'd been out trying to get help, too. She'd been going to places and getting literature and reaching out and all kinds of things like spouses, loved ones do. The people are still there and still care. But she was talking to a man that time she realized pretty quick that not only understood, but who offered a solution. And he said, hold the phone, after he listened to her sympathetically. And he went and got Lib. And Lib came on the phone and told Kay about Al-Anon.
Can you talk in the speaker a little closer, please?
Yeah, you're not hearing me?
No.
Okay. I'll start up. I'm Bill Crawford. You didn't miss it all, did you? Okay. Were you missing me too? Okay. Is that better? I was lowering my voice for effect. You've heard me say this. Some of you heard me say this before. If you are drinking alcoholically and your spouse or your loved one, the one who's still there and still cares, get into Al-Anon and starts practicing those principles. It probably will not cure your drinking. That's not what it's designed to do, but it'll break your rhythm. I'll guarantee you that. Now, you see, I'm a great believer that somebody in that mess needs to start getting well, and that's what happened. And she would say, and she does write much of this kind of work from the podium too, and she'll tell you that just an inch at a time, a little bit at a time, slowly, she started getting better. And getting better in that situation means that the power of my disease began to lose its power over her, just by a little bit, by a little bit, by a little bit. And so I credit Al-Anon as much as anything for my getting to the doorway of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was on June the 2nd of 1967, which through this moment, thank God, is my sobriety date, that she looked at me, and I'm coming off a drunk number 150, 200, whatever. It's just another drunk. And it's damage done, and I'm scared to answer the phone, and I'm scared to go to the front door, and I'm hiding and all that kind of stuff that I did at the end of my drunks. And she looked at me and said, can we call Bill? I knew who she was talking about, because I knew about Bill. She would tell me about the Wednesday night meeting she would go to, and she'd tell me about Bill, and she'd tell me about Lib. And she'd even tell me a little bit about the things they said, and I would listen. And she was treating me better, so I didn't argue. And I said, yeah. Yes. Because, you know, back in July of 66, that 10 months or whatever before, 10, 11 months before, so I was almost out of schemes and plans. I was almost empty of my bag of tricks. I was almost run out of options in my mind. But that night, I'd hit the wall. If there was another lie in me, if there was another delay tactic, if it was anything that anybody, including me, could believe for a minute, I'd probably used it, but I was out. Good place for an alcoholic to be, run out. And I said, yeah, and that was back, some of you young folks don't know about this, but that's back when you had holes in the phone, you had to dial it like that. And she'd been to enough Al-Anon to know that I'm supposed to do things for myself, but she knew coming off that drunk, I couldn't run that thing around seven times. So she dialed a phone for me. And Bill said, are you about ready to throw in the towel now? When he came to the phone. So he knew about me. He'd know about alcoholism and alcoholic drinking anyway, but he knew specifically about me because Kay would tell him. She'd report on me. And I said, I sure am, because I sure was. And he said, let me come see you in the morning. This was a fairly late hour on a Friday night. And that Saturday morning, June the 3rd, he came to see me. And sat in the living room of that little house that I was about to lose. The payments were $100 a month, and Cameron Brown Mortgage was going to foreclose on it because I hadn't made payments in a long time. And he sat in the Big Shot's living room, and he was generous with himself, like hopefully we all are when we call on that drunk. And he acted as if he cared about me. But more important than anything, he asked me if I would agree to two things. To not drink for the rest of that day and go with him to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and I agreed to do it. Now, I didn't want him picking me up. You know how we are. I want my own getaway. I want to, you know, so I'll meet you there. Now, I was really too sick to go. I needed to go tomorrow, the next day, when I felt better. But Kay had heard that deal. So nothing to do but us to go over there. And I had me a non-repossessable Mercury. I don't know if you've ever had one like that. And if you plan to do any more drinking, I'll give you this little hint. If you get a car you still owe money on, and you can wreck it just enough, the bank doesn't really want it back, but it'll still drive. You get a little leeway. You get a little latitude on that. And I had... We went over in the old Mercury, and I came to, Mike was talking about speaker meetings. Thank God for speaker meetings. If you don't have enough around Marietta, start some, because thank God for them. Nothing better for that new person, I don't think, than to come and hear somebody's story. And I came at that time in Greensboro. There were 11 meetings in the whole town. 9 groups, 11 meetings. Central meet 3 times a week, and all of them but 2 were speaker meetings. So when I came to the Stormout group, which is to this day, with some break because I moved away from Greensboro for a while, but is this day my home group. I came in and listened to people having a meeting. Now, I felt like you do if you knew, probably. I figured everybody's looking at me, wondering why I'm there, you know. That's the dumbest thought you can have in a... in any room full of alcohol. I don't care if it's the Moose Club, the Red Rooster Lounge, or Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous only pay attention to themselves, alcoholics. Everybody's checking themselves out. Nobody's looking. You can come in with 2 heads. But I thought everybody was wondering, you know, yeah, how it is. And I sat down and listened to the reading, which meant nothing to me, the same reading you heard tonight. And a guy bellied up to the podium like I'm doing tonight, and there was about 19, 20 people out there in front of him. Now Starmount has 150 to 200 people. Clancy's talked there on Saturday night. And I listened to this man do what I'm doing tonight. And I was, you know what it's like to be sober one day, your attention span's a little short. And I wasn't assimilating everything. I could not have repeated a sentence he said after that meeting, I'm sure. But two miracles occurred that night. Number one, I understood his message. And that was a big miracle. Not, you know, not details, but I understood that he was telling us that he had drunk alcohol hopelessly, just like me. And then he'd come here and he hadn't been drinking. I can't even remember how long that was, and life was good. I understood that. Miracle number two was I believed him. I hadn't believed anything, anybody in a long time. Didn't even believe in God, so I told myself. But I believed him. Now, maybe that could be explained by desperation. I didn't have any other place to go, and I was reaching so hard. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it can be explained like we usually explain things like that, by the grace of God. And after that meeting, I go over to at that time, Starmount met in a smaller room, the ladies' study or whatever it was. We went over to the fellowship hall and I watched the alcoholics drink coffee and eat cake. That's an amazing thing. What an amazing thing that is to someone who has been kicked out for life from the bamboo lounge. Now, I've been kicked out of several places. But I'm right proud of the bamboo lounge, because the bamboo lounge where you go when you couldn't go anyplace else. And I couldn't even go back there. And here I am, and these people acting as if they cared so much about me and coming up to reach out to me and watching that amazing thing of that eating that cake. I hadn't eaten cake in a long time. I thought I'd outgrown my taste for sweets. I learned by hanging around with y'all that my blood sugar stayed jacked up so high I couldn't stand to be in the same room with the pie, but I thought it was just kind of a... And a drink that coffee, cake crumbs spitting out of their mouth, hugging each other and laughing. Now, I couldn't figure things out real good, but I knew somehow that these people were better off than me, and I knew they were better off than the people at the Bamboo Lounge or the Varsity Grill or Ham's or any of those other places I'd been haunting. And I wanted to be like them. I was powerless over alcohol, and my life was unmanageable. I could not manage my affairs. I could not live life as a normal, productive, decent human being. And there was some corner of my mind that remembered what a normal, decent, productive human being was. And these people looked like that. Now, I'm going to tell you, the people that surrounded me, the winners, they surrounded me and they did the things that winners do. Winners, you know, if you've been around here a couple of weeks, no old-timer has to get you to side and say, let me tell you who the winners and the losers are. They're winners and those guys are losers. You can tell. You can tell who has that thing that you want, who's successful in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's no secret. And you can tell the people who don't have what you want. And the winners surrounded me, and that's that 12-step stuff I was talking about. We'd go up and down the road making talks at other towns, and we'd go call on drunks at all situations, take them to the hospital, and back then, the doctors in the emergency room give him a shot in the butt if he was a good doctor, and paraldehyde. Now, most of you new people never heard of paraldehyde. Wonder drug. Anytime somebody, something works, they quit using it. You could take somebody that was between D and T. I mean, they were just getting ready to go into it. You could give them a shot of paraldehyde. This is true. It's chloroform and alcohol. You give them a shot of paraldehyde and they'd be eating. They'd get an appetite. Two shots of paraldehyde, you'd tell them to line a spot that they'd want to be in and for a long time. Wonder drug. And we get that, and also it stunk, too. You're proud of it. You couldn't lose him. You know, wherever he went. Wherever he went, that you could smell that fried. Anyway. Winners do the same thing. If you've been around this program a while, what you'll discover, I think, that this is a pretty good ride. And you'll see people in on this ride, and you'll want to get on board, hopefully. I did, because I knew they were better than me. And you'll see that being on board with these people is better than it was. and then much better, and then much better, and then much better. And if you hang around a little while, I believe I can bet you what will happen. You'll realize that the people pulling their wagon are doing better than the people that are just riding in the wagon. And the people who are the winners are the people that's pulling the wagon. They're not just along for the ride. They're involved. And I did the things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous to be well. I went to the meetings. I said yes to AA requests because I was told to do and made the coffee and cleaned the ashtrays back when you could smoke and all that. Went to the prisons and shared. Went on 12-step calls and this kind of thing. And Bill said, and I'm going to shut up here in about 6 minutes. Bill said, now I want you to go to all these meetings, but do not go to the Sunday night discussion meeting. It will confuse you. There are a couple of screwballs up there that will confuse you. Stay away from that. Well, of course, I could not wait. And I started going to Sunday night discussion meeting. It wasn't hard to tell who those screwballs were, too. One came to a very tragic end not too much longer after that. He tried to kill his wife, tried to kill himself. The other one, we don't know what happened to him. But I was an agnostic and had a lot to say, so I shifted that meeting from a 2-screwball meeting to a 3-screwball meeting. And I would share some of my opinions, and people would tell me sometime in the group and sometime after the meeting, they would tell me, you know, I used to be like you. And you know what I would do? I'd get up, some of them would say, I'd get up in the morning, and even though I didn't believe, I'd ask this God that I wasn't sure really existed for a day of sobriety without a drink. And if that worked, I'd say, thank you. And I wanted this thing so bad that I even began to do that, this old agnostic. That's how I came to believe. And came to that third step prayer that we do. And did that inventory. First time it wasn't much. But the next time it was a little bit better. And I was able to put those grudges down. I didn't write an autobiography or any of that stuff. I put the inventory down like it says in the big book. I sponsored a guy. He's still a friend of mine. And we still see each other right off by the name of Robert. He's the meanest little guy I've ever known. He was the type of guy to get in a fight and bite your ear off. That kind of guy. And he had trouble starting on his inventory. I said, listen, I tell you what, get the Greensboro phone directory and mark out any name you don't know. The rest you hate, that's your grudge list. And did those things to gain that insight that would get in the program and to learn about me. And to sit down, and I've done this more than once, to sit down and tell somebody my whole life story. And I know you're afraid of that if you're new. There's a couple of things I ain't telling. I know how you do. Some of you maybe have heard say this before, but I'm going to tell you. Now, you read the big book. They say go to your lawyer, your doctor, your priest, or whatever, and give the fifth step. You don't have to do that anymore. You can do it right with your AA sponsor, someone you trust. And let me tell you a little secret, in case you hadn't found it out. AA members, sponsors, are shock-proof. So I don't care how big the secret is, you're not going to shock them. And if you do, they will never admit it. The only thing they'll do, their mind churning, say, how can I top this? Now, I tell people, a lot of times from the podium, if you want to test this, think of the worst thing that you could possibly think of. Whether you did it or not, just think of the worst act you could think of. Find you a couple of old-timers over at the coffee pot, maybe a half a dozen, and just walk up and break it on them. Just say, I ate a live rat one time. They'll nod. A couple of them say, I used to do that. The greatest relief you'll ever experience is the dumping that, the sharing of that, my story, my secrets. There are people who say around AA, and I believe it nowadays, you're as sick as your secrets. Anyway, I'm going to sit down and shut up. This is how we gain the insight. This is how we gain the knowledge. This is how we get the connection with this program in God. And you make the amends, and I know how, you know, to be free, to do steps 4 through 9, to send that money off where I owe it, to make that fix that with that person that I can't face anymore. It gives me the greatest freedom in the world. Now I can answer the phone. Now I can go to the front door. Now I can walk down any side of any street anywhere, and I don't have to change sides of the street no matter who's coming. What a freedom. And I learned to pray right here. I'd been raised in a church, but I learned to pray here. And I learned the four things I need to watch for every day, every minute of my life. If I'm out of whack, is it anger? Is it fear? Is it dishonesty? Is it selfishness? What are these? What's happening to me? And then I get the greatest gift, I think, that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us. It's the gift of giving this thing away, because I've been taught way early to be generous with my time, my energy, myself, with people who are hurting worse than me. And I found myself in that situation one time. And a wonderful feeling overcame me, a feeling that was new, unrecognizable. I recognized in retrospect that what had happened to me for just a few seconds, that I cared more about someone else than I did me. That had never happened to me. That meant I was different. I'm different now than I was a year ago. I'm much different than I was 10 years ago. For the better. I'm not wonderful. I'm not good. I'm not developed some outstanding character or any of these things. I'm just different in that way. The next time I had that feeling longer, next time the feeling lasted a little bit longer, now I can have that feeling anytime I want it, anytime I need it. To get out of me. To get out of the discomfort of living in this selfishness, self-centeredness, self-absorbed inside of me, and to go through the actions enough where I care a little bit more and a little bit more about someone else more than I do me. And for that, and all the things that have happened to me, and they're too innumerable to mention, the good things, I'm as grateful as I'm capable of being. Thank you.